of the prophets, the reason behind the miracles, the reason behind the scripture is to maintain justice. This is something that we have to give importance to. Salawat ala Muhammad wa the prophet in the Quran, the prophet was commanded to establish justice. It says, "Wa umirtu li'adla bainakum," and I was commanded to establish justice, to do justice amongst you. After the Battle of Hunain, which was a war that happened during the prophet, during the lifetime of the prophet, the Muslims got in a war and they were victorious. After the battle ended, they were distributing the war booty. In the old days, when there was a war, after the war, the soldiers would collect the swords and the armor and whatever remained from the enemies, and this would be called war booty. Then they would divide it in the way that we in Islam we divide it. So the Prophet was busy dividing this war booty, determining where the war booty should go. And one of the companions who was of weak faith, he came to the Prophet and he said, "You're being unjust. You're dividing this war booty unjustly." The Prophet became upset. It said that he became red. He was angry at that statement. He said, "Wayluka," shame on you. "Is the lam yakun al-adl," indeed, if justice is not with me, "fa'indama yakun," then who is it with? The Prophet was the strongest, the best person who would establish justice. There was no one who cared more for justice than our Prophet. Every breath that he took, he tried to establish justice throughout the world. And we have to try to emulate him. We have to try to follow him. Now, justice, there's many types of justice. Justice is a concept that's not as simple as just the opposite of oppression. Actually, the universe is founded upon justice. Justice is a law of the universe. In the books of theology, they talk about justice. When they talk about divine justice, they talk about what justice means. They give two aspects. One aspect of it is justice in the creation. It means that everything has its appointed course and everything runs along its appointed course, where the opposite would be anarchy, would be disorganization. And this is a little deeper concept. There's a statement from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. He said, "Bil adl qamat as-samawati wal ard," with justice the heavens and the earth are sustained. Right? Now, of course, those of you who know, even in English, but those of you who know Arabic, when you put something out of place in the sentence at the beginning, I'll mention it in English and then I'll show you in Arabic. In English, we know in the sentences, first comes a subject, then comes a predicate. So for instance, the sentence, the example they gave, they say the sailor is home. The sailor is the subject, home is the predicate. If you say, "Home is the sailor," it's a correct sentence, but you're putting emphasis upon home. Right? You say, "Home is the sailor." You're emphasizing home. In this sentence, the term "with justice" is out of place and put at the beginning of the sentence. And in Arabic, when you do that, it's a sign of emphasis. So here this sentence is not just, he's not just clearly saying simply that, you know, the heavens and the earth are sustained through justice or with justice. He's putting justice is what sustains the heaven and the earth. He's giving importance and emphasis to that. Now, if we look at that on a theological level, if we step away from social and political aspects and look on a theological level, there's a couple of days ago, people were asking, I think yesterday or even the day before, I think the day before, in the question and answer session, they were asking about very difficult proofs for God, the existence of God. And they were saying that we need to know the most difficult proofs, and if we don't, we won't have a strong relationship with Allah. And that's incorrect. What's important is you know that Allah exists. You have certainty in the existence of God. however you get that certainty. So there's some proofs that are easy, and there's some proofs that are more difficult. But whatever gives you certainty, that's enough for you. So if you're someone who is very picky and doesn't accept the simple proofs, then you have to go to the more difficult proofs. But if you're someone who has a clearer mind and it's easier for you to accept things, then you'll accept the easier proofs. So I wanted to mention in this point about with this sentence saying with justice meaning organization, everything is running its own course. A lot of in theology, they use this to prove the existence of God. And I'll show you how after Allah salawat ala Muhammad. For instance, if we look at the universe, the way that the planets, you know, rotate, the way that the solar system works, you see there's an amazing amount of organization. The more you look into astronomy, the more you see. And it's interesting that our elder scholars, even scholars of today, for instance, Sayyid Sistani in Qom, he has an institute of astronomy, where they teach astronomy. So a lot of scholars, they are very interested in astronomy, looking into the universe to, what's it called, to help, you know, increase their love of God, of Allah. Because the more, you know, beauty and organization you see, the stronger your faith in God becomes. But not only the universe, you could look at an ant. Look at an ant, how ants live their life, how organized they are. Look at the human body. The brother wants to become a doctor, I'm sure you've studied. Look at how amazing the human body is. All of these show you that there's some kind of organization, there's an amazing amount of organization. Now how does this prove the existence of God? Because they say, if there's organization, there has to be someone who organized it. They say it can't just come. It can't just, you know, accidentally exist. Which is what they say in science today. They say the Big Bang Theory, that all of the particles came together and exploded and then this world was created. Right? That's what they say. It was an accident. That life was an accident and it happened through a huge explosion. Now that's similar to saying in the books of theology that we have, that's similar to saying this. You have a typewriter and a monkey. Let the monkey type on the typewriter. Right? Most likely you won't get a book from that. But it's possible after a billion, 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 billion tries, he might write a Shakespeare book. It's possible. But very unlikely. And this is the example they give. Yes, it's possible that a lot of dirt came together, exploded, and this happened. But very unlikely. So they say that this is one of the proofs that one can use to prove the existence of someone who organized the universe. Because there's organization, there has to be an organizer. It's similar to the proof that says if there's something beautiful, if there's a painting that someone draws, there has to be a painter. If there's a sculpture, a beautiful sculpture, there has to be someone who sculpted it. Nothing just comes from nothing. There has to be someone who originated it. Salawat ala Muhammad wa Muhammad. Now let's go look at the story of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Let's try to apply what we're saying, justice, the establishment of justice, in the history and in the story of Imam Hussein. Because I'm saying this is one of the reasons why Imam Hussein stood up. This is one of the reasons why Imam Hussein alayhi salam sacrificed his life. So how am I saying this? Where am I getting this from? Here's a hadith where Imam Hussein alayhi salam is actually narrating a hadith from the Prophet. And I love when that happens. It makes me feel better about the hadith when the Imam narrates it from another Imam who narrates it from the Prophet. This time it's directly, Imam Hussein alayhi salam narrating it from the Prophet. He says this, Imam Hussein alayhi salam. He says, there is no doubt that the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. If we're going to recite the salawat, let's recite it right. There's no doubt that the Prophet said this in his lifetime. He said, whoever sees an oppressive ruler, what's this oppressive ruler do? who prohibits the divine prohibitions and breaks divine pledges, who allows the prohibitions to take place and breaks the divine pledges. What else does he do? Who opposes the sunnah of the Messenger of Allah and who performs sins in the open. Whoever sees an oppressive ruler do this and does not react, does not do anything, allows the status quo to go as is. Whoever does this on the day of judgment will be raised with that ruler. So the people who saw, for instance, Muawiyah and Yazid and did nothing, on the day of judgment, they'll be raised with Muawiyah and Yazid. But let's not look at that time. Today, those of us who see oppressive rulers, who see the Yazids of today, and do nothing, on the day of judgment, we'll be raised with them. Is that who we want to be raised with? Or do we want to be raised with the Husseins of today? If we want to be raised with the Husseins of today, we have to do something. We have to stand up to the oppressors. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala. Now, during the time of Imam Hussein al-Islam, there was a lot of oppression. I mentioned in the last few days, I've been mentioning many different instances of oppression that existed at that time. A few days ago I mentioned racism. I wanted to expand a little bit on that, and then we'll go into a different topic of oppression that existed at that time. Now racism at that time, basically what happened is the Arabs considered themselves superior to the non-Arabs at that time. Okay, after the Prophet's demise, during the time of the Khulafa, this tribalism and this racism was reinstated. During the Prophet's time it was destroyed, after it started to creep back into the society. There's a hadith of the Prophet which rejects this. We know that Islam is against racism, but I just want to, last time I brought a verse of Quran, this time I'm going to mention a hadith, just so we have, you know, some backing in our own minds, so we could think about it in a better way, inshallah. He says this, La fadla la arabi ala ajami. There's no virtue, there's no merit of an Arab over a non-Arab. وَلَا لَعَجْمِ عَلَىٰ أَرَبِ. And not for the non-Arab, over the Arab. So there's no merits or virtue being an Arab or a non-Arab. And he continues, وَلَا لَعَسْوَدُ لَأَحْمَىٰ. And not for a dark-skinned person over a red-skinned person. And وَلَا لَأَحْمَىٰ لَأَسْوَدُ. And not for a red-skinned person over a dark-skinned person. So then what's the virtue? What's the merit? إِلَّا بِتَقْوَىٰ. Except piety. So our race, where we're from, what nationality we are, has no bearing on if we're a virtuous person or not. Has no bearing if we're good or bad. The only thing that counts is taqwa. The only thing that counts is piety. Now I mentioned piety again. I mentioned this in a couple speeches. We had a question and answer session where we got into it. But this is something that needs to be driven home. This is something that needs to be ingrained in your minds. That piety is the base of our religion. We need to be pious. We need to at least have that, if we don't have anything higher than that. Now, what was piety? You should be able to tell me, because I've said it a few times now. Piety, simply, is the state that you become when you perform all of your obligations and you stay away from all of the prohibitions. When you do all of your wajibs and you stay away from everything that's haram. Once you do that, you have taqwa, you're pious. And this is the goal, this is the base, we have to at least have this. So inshallah we'll make a sincere effort, a sincere intention to try to gain this piety if we don't already have it. And if we have it, we'll pray to keep it, inshallah. Salawat ala Muhammad wa sallam. Now, as I said, there was a lot of oppression during this time in history. The Khulafa, they misappropriated the public treasury. the public treasure.
Beit HaMikdash.
Now, this was especially in the case of the third Khalifa, the third Khalifa. He would spend it incorrectly. He would give more of it to his family members and less of it to the other Muslims. Right? It was so much so that the people rose up and killed him. We know Shias don't study too much this 25-year history between the demise of the Prophet and when Imam Ali alayhi salam became, you know, the accepted leader of Islam. This 25 years we don't study in depth like we do the rest. But it's very interesting that because of his actions, the people of Medina rose up and killed him because he was spending the public treasury incorrectly. Now, a lot of our other Muslim brothers will say it wasn't the people of Medina who killed him. They'll say people came from other cities and attacked him. In either case, whichever one is correct, if the people of Medina killed him, or if they allowed other people to come and kill him without protecting him, in either case, you could see that they were upset with him. They did not accept this oppression. It got to such a point, there was so much oppression that they had to stand up. Now, he was killed. Imam Ali came. Imam Ali, for just a few years, tried to bring the Islamic government back to a state of justice, but he had all of these wars. He wasn't able to do everything that, you know, he could have, because the people didn't really accept him. After him, Muawiyah came. Muawiyah was worse than before. Not only did he misappropriate, you know, the division of Bayt al-Mal, of the public treasury, he even spent it on horrendous things. For instance, he paid a number of people to forge traditions, to make false traditions. He paid this from the money of the Muslims. He paid people to lie about the Prophet and say that the Prophet said good things about Muawiyah, for instance. Said Muawiyah was promised heaven. Said Muawiyah is this, the commander of the faithful, this and that. But even worse than that, he paid people to forge traditions against Imam Ali alayhi salam, to curse Imam Ali. It got to such a point in this short period of time after the Prophet's demise. It got to such a point that people would curse Imam Ali alayhi salam after every salat. That, you know how we do tasbihat al-zahra? They would curse Imam Ali. When we say Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar three times, they would curse Imam Ali. There's a story in Damascus of a person, a Muslim, who went to the masjid and he prayed, and after the prayer he did some of the taqibat and he did some du'as and he left the masjid. When he was walking home, he remembered he forgot to curse Imam Ali. He stood in the middle of the street. He cursed Imam Ali, and then he built a masjid where he remembered. That's how important it was. This is how bad Muawiyah was. This is how much work he did against the Ahlul Bayt. Now, after him, Yazid was worse. Yazid committed all of the open crimes that I said. He didn't care at all for Islam. But it's interesting that some of our Muslim brothers and sisters would argue with us. They would say that, no, these people, yes, they did this, but it wasn't bad. And we'd say, how can you say it's not bad? First of all, Muawiyah is paying people to lie about the Prophet. Yazid is drinking alcohol, killing people, adultery, all this stuff he does in the open. How can you say that's not bad? They would say, I'm telling you this because when you hear it, you have to have an answer for it. They would say, they're doing it, this was their own ijtihad. This term ijtihad. This was their ijtihad, this is what they thought was right, and they're doing what they thought was right. Now, brothers, ijtihad is a very important concept in Islam. This is one of the reasons why Shia Islam remains right now, after 1400 years, because we have this concept of ijtihad, the doors are still open. Yes, there's a huge difference of opinion between the Sunni opinion of what ijtihad is and the Shia opinion of what ijtihad is. There's a difference of opinion. But in both cases, ijtihad means deriving religious laws from their sources. In Shia Islam, we say the sources are the Quran, authentic traditions, and certain rational arguments. These three, nothing else. We say consensus as well, but consensus, when you look into it, it's actually connected to authentic traditions. These are the three sources we have. In the Sunni sects, they add a couple other things to it. Okay? But it doesn't mean that they could do whatever they want. So if they say it's ijtihad, you know, Yazid was using his ijtihad to say you could drink alcohol. That doesn't make any sense. Because ijtihad is deriving rulings from their sources. The Quran clearly says it's haram. Yazid was doing ijtihad to say that he could commit adultery. No, he's doing what he wants to do. There's no Islamic proof. He's not going to the sources and proving it. So there's a when they use this argument, they're trying to cover up what happened. They're trying to run away from the discussion because they know they have nothing to say. But we know that this was not the case. They were not doing ijtihad. They were enemies of Islam. They were fighting the Ahlul Bayt. They were oppressing the Islamic Ummah. They were oppressing Muslims. And when they were oppressing Muslims, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, at this time when it reached its peak under Yazid, he had to stand up. He had to listen to what the Prophet said. The Prophet said, when you see an oppressor ruling over the side that's doing this, that, and the other, and you don't do anything, you'll be raised up with it. You have to react. You have to do something. Imam Hussein did something. He stood up. He sacrificed everything. He sacrificed his friends, his family, his self, his own head, in order to establish justice in this society. And this is something that we should hold dear. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Now at the end of the speeches, I always mention a practical aspect. I say that these speeches that I'm giving are not merely theoretical. I'm not trying to give you some kind of theory that you could go home and think about. I want to give you something practical that you'll go home and do. Action is what I want. Inshallah, after my speeches, inshallah, you've already started to act. But inshallah, by the time I leave, you will act. And inshallah, I will act upon what I'm saying as well. Now, in this case, what is practical about what I'm saying? It's easy. Don't oppress and don't allow oppression. Stand up to oppression. But how? Now let's look. Everywhere in the world, people are being oppressed. Everywhere. In Pakistan, Shias are being killed. Wahhabis are coming in, blowing up masjids, blowing up an Ashura. I guarantee you, you know, I hope not, I pray it doesn't happen, but I'm sure some Shias will be killed, you know, while they're mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. In Afghanistan, people are oppressed. In Iraq, people are oppressed. In Palestine, people are oppressed. And if I'm missing anywhere, don't get offended. Everywhere, people are oppressed. In Latin America, people are oppressed. In Africa, they're oppressed. In China, they're oppressed. Everywhere. In America, under our noses, in front of our eyes, people are oppressed. Even here, we have to stand up for it. Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, he, in numerous cases, when he was in some of the times when he was doing tafsir of certain verses, in some speeches of his, he would mention that a Muslim must always stand up for oppression wherever it is, and whoever is being oppressed must be supported. It doesn't matter if they're Muslim or non-Muslim. It doesn't matter. Now look at this, look at the world right now. We see that Muslims, unfortunately, are known as terrorists in the world. You know, outside of Muslims themselves. The media portrays Muslim in a very bad light. People look down upon Muslims and Islam right now. But still, in these conditions, Many people are becoming Muslim. Many people are converting to Islam. Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world, even though it's known as a terrorist religion. Imagine if Islam was known as a religion who supports the oppressed, a religion who helps the downtrodden. If this is how people knew Islam, villages would become Muslim, cities would become Muslim, people would run towards Islam. If we do what we're ordered to do, if we do what Allah tells us to do, the world will become a much better place. People will realize that Islam is the correct religion, is the truth, is the best way of life. It's because we don't do this, it's because I'm lazy, it's because all of us are lazy and we don't do what we're supposed to do. Now Imam Khomeini was not like me and you. He acted upon what he said, upon what he knew. And it was very interesting. Regarding America, I remember when I heard this, I was amazed. In 1980, I was 2 years old. I'm sure a lot of you remember that time better than me. Some of you weren't even born. In 1980, Iranian university students overtook the American embassy in Iran. They jumped the fences, and they captured all of the American workers who were working in the embassy, and they imprisoned them. Now, when this happened, Imam Khomeini praised them. He said, "What you did was very good, but you did something else as well. A few of the people who were captured, two or three, I forgot the number, were African American." Imam Khomeini said, "These people, we're freeing them. We're freeing the African Americans. Why?" He said, "You are oppressed in your own country. We're not going to oppress you here." And he let them go. In Los Angeles, forget about the whole world. In Los Angeles, on that day, so many African Americans became Muslim. A huge number. I've met a number of them, you know, later on in my life. And they say, "That is the day I became Muslim." When I saw this on the news, because they played this on the news. Sometimes things slip in the media and they don't know the importance of it. This is one of those that slipped through. They played this in the news, and African Americans throughout the United States became Muslim because they saw someone is standing up for their oppression. Someone is supporting them, and it's a Muslim. If we support the oppressed, you'll see huge, huge results, I promise you. Now, there's a concept called wali al-faqih that I've been asked about numerous times on this trip. It's a detailed concept, it's an in-depth concept, and I don't want to get into the details of it right now. Maybe on a question and answer session, if you want to ask questions about it, maybe we could talk about it then. But one thing that I want to point out, because a lot of times people say, you know, "I accept the wali al-faqih, but how do I follow him in the United States? I do taqlid, for instance, to Sayyid Sistani. So what does wali al-faqih mean to me when my marja is someone else?" The answer is this. How we can follow it here is that we listen to what he says on a political and social level, and we try to implement it. It's that easy. For instance, let me give you an example. In the, what's it called, the Eid al-Fitr prayers a few months ago, He always leads them, and he gave a speech. In his speech, he said a number of things, but two things on a political level. He said the most imminent issue, the most important issue that's happening right now in the Islamic world are the floods in Pakistan. We need to help, you know, the people in Pakistan overcome this huge natural disaster. This was a couple months ago. Then he said, but the main issue that all Muslims should hold dear is the issue of Palestine. We should hold, this is the most important issue. This is what we should be concentrating on. So how could we follow wali al-faqih? We concentrate on that issue. Now, a lot of people, especially in the UK, but I've heard it in the States as well, they say, wait a second, in Palestine, there's Sunnis. Yes, it's bad, they're being oppressed. You know, the Israelis are killing the Sunnis. But in Pakistan, Shias are being killed. Why should you know, this Sunni country be given more importance than Pakistan? The answer is this, because maybe a lot of you even have that question. The answer is this. Palestine is a base of oppression. It's a huge base. If Palestine did not exist, a lot of the oppression that happens in the Islamic world would disappear. The Western countries, the Zionists, or you know, whatever entities, they use this base in Palestine to create all of their division and all of their fitna and do all of the stuff that they do. I guarantee you, if there's a solution in Palestine, if the Palestinian crisis becomes solved, I guarantee you a lot of the oppression that we see will go away. We have that verse that I mentioned before, وَقُوْ جَاهَ الْحَقِّ وَزَهَكَ الْبَاطِلُ in al-Batil kana zuhukan. When, say, truth comes, when truth comes, falsehood will vanish. Verily, falsehood is bound to vanish. Once that's this alone. Now, what can we do in the United States? First of all, I want to make it very clear so if other people are listening or whoever, I'm not saying don't do anything militarily, nothing. There is no physical obligation that we have at all. So what's our duty? Our duty is education, as I've been saying throughout all of these nights. We have to learn about the issue and we have to teach people about it. The more people know about the truth of the issue, the more advances will be made in our cause. Education is key. Another thing that we could do is boycott. Boycotting is important. A lot of people, they say yes, you know, if there's questions that are asked in the margin. If we know 100% that a company supports Israel, can we buy something from them? They say no. And then a lot of times we say, oh, you know, let's not do the research. I don't know for sure, 98% I know, but I don't know for sure, so it's okay for me to buy. Or, oh, you know, if I don't, you know, get, you know, this brand of coffee, then I won't be able to drink coffee. There's no more coffee for me when you can get generic coffee. We make a lot of excuses for ourselves, but we can. And if everybody does it, it has an effect. These are two practical things that we could do, education and boycott. Now, inshallah, please give three loud salawats for Abbas ibn Ali alayhi salam, and we'll start. Because he was the last person, the last soldier before Imam Hussein alayhi salam to give his life. So he saw everything that Imam Hussein saw except for his own shahada. He saw all of the companions slaughtered. He saw his own family members slaughtered. His sons, his nephews, his cousins, all killed. After the time when it was only him and Imam Hussein left, he was very upset. It was very difficult. He saw all of this, you know, all of this stuff happened. He saw that his brother, the Imam, was surrounded by the enemies. He heard the cries of the women and children because of thirst. He was in a very difficult place. And he knew it was his time to ask for permission. He went to his brother, he asked for permission. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he didn't want to give permission. He loved his brother, he loved Abbas. They grew up together. They were best friends. Abbas would always support Imam Hussein. He was always his backbone. And the response that Imam Hussein gave when he asked for permission, Imam Hussein said, but you're my standard bearer, you're the one who carries my flag. He didn't want to say yes. Abbas continued, he said, look, you know, I'm fed up with these hypocrites. Let me seek revenge, let me avenge you. Imam Hussein knew he had to accept. So he told him, he ordered him to get water for the children. He said, go get water first. Go get water for the children. Now, we know that the river bank, the Euphrates, was guarded by a lot of soldiers. It wasn't easy to go get water. So Hazrat Abbas, he went out forward, and he tried to talk to the people. Tried to talk to the enemy. He's like, look, fear Allah. What's wrong with you guys? Fear Allah. Give them water. They didn't accept. Then he said, look, this is Hussein, the son of Ali. The son of Ali, the daughter of... This is Hussein, the son of the daughter of the Messenger of Allah. These are his children. They're dying of thirst. Give them some water. The thirst is burning their hearts. It was said that this affected the army. They saw that the soldiers started thinking, yes, why don't we give the children water? What's wrong with us? Give them some water. It's like, the children didn't do anything to us. When Shimmer saw this, Shimmer yelled, he screamed. He said, O son of Abu Turab, if all of the earth was water and it was all in our hands, we wouldn't give you one drop of it unless you pled allegiance to Yazid. That's the only way you'll get water, for any of you. Abbas knew, okay, they're not listening. So he went back to the camp to tell Imam Hussein that they're not listening and I'm going to have to take matters into another way. When he was moving back, he heard the cries of the children of the Ahl al-Bayt. And this was the last straw. This is what broke him. He said, that's it, I'm going to go get water. He threw the water pouch over his neck and he jumped on the horse and he went. It was an epic charge. Arrows were being shot from him from all angles. There was a number of enemy soldiers guarding this riverbank. But he was able to go through. He was able to push through. And he reached the bank. He reached the water. He reached the Euphrates. It said that he kneeled down and he got water for himself. He was thirsty. He got water for himself, and right before he was going to drink it, he remembered his brother Imam Hussein. He said, how could I drink this water when my Imam is thirsty? How can I drink this water when the children of Hussein are dying of thirst? He threw it back. He said, this is not in me. It's not me to do this. I'll drink when they drink. He put the water pouch over his head after he filled it up, jumped back on his horse, and raced to the camps. But there were too many soldiers. The soldiers realized that he got there, and the soldiers started to surround him. He was pushing through them and pushing through. It was Abbas, the son of Imam Ali. He was pushing through them. But one of them was hiding behind a tree. And when he went past him, he hit Abbas with the sword. He hit him on his right arm. It severed his arm. And it was said that he was holding the flag and he grabbed it with his left. He said, by Allah, if you cut my right arm off and I'll still defend the religion. And he went forward with one arm. He went forward, another enemy was hidden behind another tree, hit him in his left arm. His arm was severed. His arm fell. Now the enemies were brave. There was no way he could defend himself. They started shooting arrows at him. A couple of the arrows hit the pouch and all the water spilled. When the water spilled, his desires left. That was it. Then an arrow hit him in the chest. Arrows hit him all over. Someone came from behind and hit him with a pole, a stick or something. And he fell. When he was falling, he said, Alaykum minni salam ya Abdullah. He said, may my peace be on you, O son of O Abu Abdullah. Imam Hussein ran over. He ran to his side. But imagine, kneeling down next to his brother, looking at his body like that. A body without arms. His face was covered in blood. His eyes couldn't see. And just imagine that. This is when Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he said, Akhi Abu Fadl, my brother Abu Fadl, Al-An in Kasra Dahri, now my back is broken. Inna Lillahi wa Inna Ilayhi Raji'un. May Allah curse the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt. Inshallah, may Allah give us all the strength to be followers like Abbas. May Allah give us the strength to recognize oppression and stand up to it. May Allah give us the strength to get closer and closer to Allah through serving the Ahlul Bayt. May Allah bless our leader, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in protecting these times.
Allah.